Good morning, everyone. I will call the remote hearing of the Local Government Division to order. Today is February 10th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by public house information. And if Josh will start with the roll call, please.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Guam.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
All members are present.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the minutes for February 3rd, 2021. Representative Quam, have you had a chance to read them?
Madam Chair, I would so move.
Thank you. All those in favor of the minutes as presented, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The minutes stand approved. Thank you very much. Today we're very fortunate to have Commissioner Mary Liz Holberg talk to us. She co-chaired the meeting, the Blue Ribbon Task Force that the governor had on metro governance. And I think is Judd here as well? I didn't see it originally.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, nice to have you.
Nice to see you, Madam Chair.
Mary Liz, the floor is yours if you would like to give us an overview of the task force. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay? Get a thumbs up from... Okay, good.
You are fine.
So I'm going to try and go through this fairly rapidly, and this is a brief presentation, but the entire report ended up being 324 pages, and I'm sure you've all read every page of it, so there won't be any questions, I'm sure. But first, I need to provide a brief disclaimer that I'm appearing today in front of you as an individual. My comments today don't represent the Dakota County Board or any position of the board, and I just want to make that clear. So thank you for the opportunity to present today. And next slide, please. So last summer, Governor Walz issued an executive order and called together a group of individuals to look at various elements of the Met Council and its role. And we met entirely by Zoom, which was rather unique, and over a period of about 4 months put together the report that's being presented here. Next slide, please. As you can see, the members of the board were a really good mix of people, former MnDOT and Met Council staff, a couple former chairs of the Met Council, representatives from business, academia, and then for good measure, a couple mayors and a couple commissioners. Next slide, please. Over a period of 4 months, we had 7 meetings. We reviewed hundreds of pages of background information going back decades. We heard various testimony from metro cities, groups representing the counties, various policy groups, and the League of Women Voters. And we were particularly lucky to have presentations by House staff Deb Dyson and Matt Bress, and also Judith from the Legislative Auditor's Office. Next slide, please. So we came up with some findings and recommendations, starting with elected versus appointed Met Council. There was a pretty strong support that there should not be an entirely elected Met Council. It could result in a mini legislature, if you will, and one legislature in Minnesota, I think we can all agree, is enough. And also, there was discussion around sitting local officials and having serious concerns about perceived real conflicts of interest, not sharing the same goals as far as individual areas versus regional systems, time commitments, and serving in two political subdivisions in kind of the issue of the regulator versus the regulated party. And so that the issue of an entirely elected Met Council was pretty overwhelmingly rejected. Next slide, please. So what was recommended is in the elected versus appointed realm was for providing for staggered terms that would allow for some continuity of knowledge, and you wouldn't lose the institutional knowledge. I think that from the way there's one sitting member that's been on the council since the Pawlenty administration, that would be Wendy Wolf from Dakota County. And I believe only Deb Barber was appointed from the Dayton administration to the Walz administration. So even without a change of party control in the governor's office, we see major overwhelming new appointment and really a lack of institutional knowledge on the council. So the other portions of this that we also looked at the nominating committee process. We believe that there should be more electeds on the nominating committee and adding more transparency in the process, whereby there would be a recommendation that up to three finalists for each seat be published with their qualifications, and that there be at least a 14-day review period before the governor would make his appointments. Next slide, please. So the next issue we looked at was the Metropolitan Council's role as a metropolitan planning organization. Some of these issues definitely bleed into the jurisdiction of the Transportation Committee as well, but the findings related to that is that this issue has been discussed, litigated, reviewed, and that at every turn the federal government has upheld the Met Council's role as a metropolitan planning organization. And under the current federal constraints, to change the metropolitan planning organization is quite onerous in its process, in that it must have the agreement of 75% of the region's, the local units of government of 75% of the region's population, and including the region's largest city, Minneapolis. And currently, Met Council's urbanized area extends into Wisconsin, according to the federal regs. And so you could also run into an issue of having to work on a reorganization with another state, that being Wisconsin. The TABS advisory board has been a longstanding process. General consensus that it worked really pretty well, but we do have some findings or some recommendations in that area as well. So next slide, please. So one of the things that was discussed was that the recommendations from the Transportation Advisory Board should be of 60% or a super majority rather than a simple majority. And also in one of the things that was discussed, or not included as an official recommendation, was the opportunity to strengthen the percentage of elected versus appointed on the Transportation Advisory Board. And we fully recognize that the complement of city and county representation was a long negotiated element of the current tab, but that by reducing some of the appointed members, turning them into ex officio, you could accomplish a greater elected strength without upsetting the current balance of city and county folks on the tab. Next slide, please. And then we looked at regional transit service and findings, and this, some of this will also, in addition to transportation impact, it could impact health and human services. And so we, the committee recognized that Metro Mobility is a federally mandated program and recommended that certainly supporting the most current change in that, in that it be a separate budget line item, but similar to this type of federally mandated transportation service in greater Minnesota, that the budget should for this should be a forecasted amount and separate from the budgeting of the Metro Transit bus, what you would view as a more traditional transit funding. There also was some discussion around opt-outs, whether or not they were effective. There was discussion in particular around kind of the conflict of interest in that you have the funder also being an operator, and there was some discussion about whether the actual funding of transit might be transferred to MnDOT, where they, similar to they do in greater Minnesota, and so that Metro Transit and the opt-outs would compete on an equal footing, if you will, rather than this rather odd situation where you have the Met Council in some cases even competing in the same corridors with redundant service. So that was not a recommendation, but an issue that was discussed. Next slide, please. So here were the recommendations again on that area about the base budget being a forecasted program, that there should be, of course, financial support to the regional system, and that because this whole issue of are opt-outs effective, is Metro Transit effective, what's more efficient, there was wide belief that the opt-outs allowed opportunity for innovation and more localized decision-making in the transit options. It was far beyond this committee's ability to make any type of evaluation or recommendation to efficiencies. And so it was recommended that an independent review be done, maybe like every 5 years, to evaluate effectiveness, whether we're getting similar type service, if there's parity, equity, geographic balance, et cetera. So that was a new recommendation as well, recognizing that there'd be a cost associated with this, and also the importance of this process being done independently and not by the Met Council itself. Next slide, please. So I think I kind of covered the actual recommendations in the finding slide here, but I think in closing, what I'd like to say is that first of all, Met Council staff provided the support for this whole process. We're grateful to them, but the actual agenda and what was discussed, et cetera, was determined by the committee, not the Met Council. And again, I think we had a really good group. Certainly this doesn't solve all the concerns or address all the concerns. I believe that Met Council will continue to be controversial. Given its appointment by the governor, it's certainly subject to criticism on a partisan scale. But the recommendations of the group as a whole was the full-scale reform or doing away with it were not viable options, and that some minor reforms may make those criticisms a little less harsh. So with that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, and I know I need to make an apology. You are the chair of this Blue Ribbon Committee. Yesterday, we were dealing with a committee that had co-chairs. I'm sorry. I have a question, and I noticed that, you know, there was quite a diversity among the members of the committee. Given the fact that this you're dealing with the metropolitan area, why did they think that the governor should be the person to make the appointments?
Well, I think that the issue is more about what would be the alternative. There was pretty strong, if not unanimous, support or opposition, if you will, of an entirely elected Met Council looking at that. I mean, that's Portland's model, the amount of money, that just didn't seem like a viable alternative that, it may solve some issues, but had the high likelihood of creating a whole new set of issues. So I think that the recommendation to put more strength into the nominating process of local elected officials, tried to get, more input in that area, and also the staggered terms. I mean, when you look at the fact of a 16-member council and you only have Wendy Wolf from Lakeville surviving two administrations and Deb Barber being the only one that was a holdover from the Dayton administration to the Walz administration. As you know, as legislators, it takes years sometimes to get into the nuances, history, and realities of particular issue areas. So if you have this wholesale changeover every 4 years, that lack of institutional knowledge and perspective is something that should maybe try and be mitigated a little bit. And also, if you had a change of politics, if you will, from one governor's administration to the next, you would at least have a 2-year period of time in which you would maybe two different philosophies would have to find some consensus in moving particular policies, and there'd be less opportunity to lurch, if you will. And this is not a perfect analogy, but from left to right every 4 or 8 years.
And I do have a bill for the staggered term, so thank you for enforcing that one. We haven't had a hearing on that yet. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Members. Yeah. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I'm not seeing a raised hand buttons this morning for some reason, but anyway, I served, of course, on the Metropolitan Council for 8 years before coming to this job. And even though before that I had previously served on the Met Council's Transportation Advisory Board for several years and its Land Use Advisory Commission for several years and its Geographic Information Systems coordination body for several years, I still found that, the wide variety of programs that the Metropolitan Council plans and manage, the learning curve is really steep. So I want to, second everything that Commissioner Holberg, has said about, with the current process and the wholesale turnover of members with each incoming administration, regardless of the party affiliation. It results in a situation where all of the institutional knowledge in the body at the beginning of every administration rests with the staff, and it leads to very staff-driven processes. So I very strongly support really all of the recommendations of this Blue Ribbon Council. They're small steps, but they're all steps in the right direction.
Thank you. Commissioner Holbert, did you want to make any comments?
No, thank you. I concur.
Okay, great. Thank you, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Holbrook, for all your work on this. Did you go into a little bit more detail in the report? I can read it later. I have not had a chance to read the whole thing. I have kind of skimmed it, though. On the opt-outs and what are some of your suggestions to create more efficiency between Met Council and the opt-outs?
Well, again, I think that we recognize the controversy around opt-outs, the depth of it, and again, you know, I'll speak for myself personally. I think there is an inherent conflict when you have the funder also being an operator, and that causes friction and problems. And there was no majority opinion on. I mean, there was some discussion around getting rid of opt-outs. There wasn't, you know, enough support to make that a recommendation. It was just, there were a lot of assertions made. Of course, we heard from representatives from the suburban transit group. They may, you know, they testified to their ability to be more efficient, more nimble, more able to address the needs of their local communities. And we really didn't feel like we had any measurable matrix to make the evaluation, you know, of the validity of those claims, and thought that this this evaluation process, independent, you know, every 3 to 5 years or whatever, would begin to provide some standard for evaluation of those claims. I think that one of the things that historically, and again, just from my own perspective, is that we don't have good comparative data to have like cost per passenger mile, ridership numbers, and that there should be some effort to have some continuity of reporting and standards across all the systems, so that evaluation may be able to occur a couple years down the line, that we're comparing elements of the system that would be apples to apples, of course, recognizing that the general nature of an opt-out versus Metro Transit are different. Dakota County is unique in that we have Metro Transit, we have Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and we have outside the transit taxing district. So we have kind of the soup to nuts in Dakota County, and often see some of the tension and conflicts between those different situations.
Any counter comments, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, thank you. I will definitely be digging into the report there, and it sounds like there's some space for improvement. Thank you.
I can state that I have certain biases. I have served on the board for the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and I can definitely tell you, yes, there is a lot of contention, because the board members for the opt-outs are all sitting city council members, elected members. So it is, when we make a decision and it is countered by the Met Council, who are appointed members, that's a huge source of controversy. And I guess, and I can't remember if it was discussed in the meeting, where normally the opt-out should be more on a partnership level rather than being subordinate. So the thought about going to under MnDOT certainly seems like something that could be, you know, that might be an option to kind of relieve some of that tension. But I do know that the ratings that we get from the users of the MBTA are all very, very high. And I don't, but I haven't made comparisons to all of the transit entities. Any other questions? And So again, I want to thank Commissioner Holberg for coming here and also for serving as chair on this, on the Blue Ribbon Committee, because it's, as we all know, this is a controversial entity. And I know when we were talking, the thought is it doesn't make any difference what governor is in charge at the particular time or what their previous thoughts were. Once they get to be governor and get to make the appointments, they are very, you know, they're not going to, it's really difficult to give them, give away their power. And I guess that's understandable. But again, the reason I asked the first question, it is dealing with metropolitan governments, a certain number of entities. And I still have problems with being the, just the fact that the governor has that much power over the metro area. But again, I am not seeing any questions. Thank you, both Commissioner Holberg and Mr. Chatton.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess in looking back a little bit, I tallied up, and since being appointed to the Planning Commission in the city of Lakeville, more than half of my life I've served in appointed or elected positions at this point, and was recalling my early days as a state representative, and former Representative Mark Biskins had a bill to get rid of the Met Council, and that was in the early 2000s, and that bill was over 700 pages long at the time. And I'm guessing since then, more duties and responsibilities have been added by the legislature. So I'm guessing if we were to see a similar bill today, it would probably be over 1,000 pages long. So this issue is a perennial issue. It ebbs and flows, and maybe some of these minor reforms that were recommended will help mitigate some of that. So thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Take care and have a good day.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to all you do.
And you as well. And next, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Representative Elkins so that I can present my bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We have the bill we have for consideration today is House File 527. This bill was referred to the division by the chair of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Representative Mason, will you move that House File 527 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee?
I do so move.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So, to your bill.
Thank you very, very much. Many of you have heard this bill before. Representative Tapke carried it last session, so it's been an ongoing thought. And it's also very controversial. We're aware of that as well. And having been on a city council, I can tell you probably some of the most, how would I put it? Trying to fund roads can be an incredibly emotional experience in many cases. And it's a real difficult one, but obviously we can't have development without having roads. And hence the bill that we have today. And I'm pleased to have Irene Cao from the Minnesota League of Cities with us today. And in lieu of time, because we do have a number of testifiers today, I'm going to let her give the details to the bill, and then we can go into the testifiers if that's okay.
Thank you, Ms. Cao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Mason. My name is Irene Cao, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just as a reminder, I know you had a presentation by the League earlier in the session, but the League is a statewide membership organization. And of the 853 cities in the state, 835 are members. Now, while this bill most directly benefits communities that are growing, there's broad support for this bill. In member packets, you saw a joint letter of support, from city organizations such as Metro Cities, the Municipal Legislative Commission, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, as well as the North Metro Mayors Association. The other thing I wanted to share with you is that there have been a number of cities across the state that have adopted resolutions in support of this bill. In fact, we have almost 40. So they range from the northwestern part of the state to the southeastern part of the state, from small cities that are smaller than 1,000 to our suburban cities. Now, quickly, I just want to talk to you a little bit about why this bill is needed. There was a time when cities were collecting fees for future street improvements. And so they weren't improving the streets at the time. Think maybe you add a turn lane or you widen the road. Cities thought that they were doing things right. But then there was a Minnesota Supreme Court case that found that there was not statutory authority for cities to collect this fee. And so cities tried to operate the best that they could in light of that fact. Unfortunately, as cities were trying to find alternative ways, they continued to get sued. And so the legislature is in a unique place to be able to fix this problem. It will provide clarity both for builders and developers, as well as cities and local governments themselves. Now, really, the problem, the crux of the problem, which you're going to hear from other testifiers as well, boils down to the fact that these streets, these roads need to be funded. When there's increased residents that are coming to a community, you need to be able to get to their homes. So who pays for that? Should it be those who are responsible for the development, or should it be the existing tax base? Now, as to the bill itself, I will say that in working with stakeholders in trying to take in their concerns, the bill you have in front of you includes a lot of safeguards. We wanted to ensure that there were those safeguards in place. So you'll see that any funds that are collected are in a special account, that developers are only responsible for the proportion of the impact that they will have for the streets. And there's also a process in there to dispute the fees. All of these to have been to ensure that there are protections, not just that cities are collecting the fees and saying, trust us, which you'll hear from the other testifiers that we do a lot, that's where that is trustworthy. But we wanted to ensure that this legislation took that in mind. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions at the end, but I'd like it to turn over to the next testifier.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Gavis. Appreciate your testimony. The next testifier is Kurt Briggs, the mayor of City of Prior Lake.
thank you so much. Chair, representatives, my name is Kurt Briggs, and I am the mayor of Prior Lake. I'd like to thank Chair Mason as well as Representatives Albright, Elkins and Hansen for their authorship and leadership, bringing House File 527 forward as a critically important piece of legislation for us growing communities. My background is a mural today, and it was recently painted in downtown Prior Lake. In most Zoom meetings, it's simply used to orient others to where I'm from. But for today, it's a visual that speaks to the challenges facing growing communities. Over my right shoulder here, you're going to see Prior Lake Past, a rural landscape, canoes, and steam locomotives. And over my left shoulder, you're going to see Prior Lake today and as it relates to this file, Prior Lake Future. And indeed, House File 527 has a direct and significant implications on the future growth of Prior Lake and what the refresh on this mural will look like in 2040. Prior Lake is a rapidly growing outer ring suburb. We are a city today of 27,000, set to grow to 40,000 by 2040, a 50% increase in population. Those opportunities and challenges that we face now are not new. Many of our inner ring neighboring cities experience them as well. What is different for us is that Minnesota Supreme Court decision of 2018, as Ms. Gao alluded to, removed a tool from our growth toolbox that had been used for decades, not only by Prior Lake, but many of the cities that have already fully built out. We had collected that street incrementally that was levying on each new housing start to provide a financial base to enhance, again, the road capacity and the safety of our roads as vehicle trips mounted. Adding 50% more residents requires that capacity be added for sewer, water, stormwater, parks, and, of course, our roads. Fortunately, statute does provide us, the cities, we can collect four of those five fees on our infrastructure systems. And House File 527 serves to really address that fifth infrastructure sizing issue. Traffic engineers will share with you that each new home adds 10 vehicle trips per day onto our roadway network. I'd like to quickly place that vehicle demand in the context of our existing road network for a growing community. As an illustrative example, I share with you an intersection of two city roads in Prior Lake and recently annexed land in Spring Lake Township. To the north is a 40-acre parcel. To the east, to the west, and to the south is a 40-acre parcel. The land currently sits as agricultural area. Given our density growth, one 40-acre parcel will become 128 homes in the city of Prior Lake. Those 128 homes are going to immediately present 1,280 vehicle trips to this hypothetical intersection after being built out. And then when the other three quarters develop, that's 5,000 vehicles a day. Certainly left turn lanes, right turn lanes, and potentially a traffic improvement will be needed to serve that growing area. So House File 527 provides that city with a tool to equitably collect a fee as development occurs orderly. Absent the fee, we're left with three untenable alternatives. The first, declare growth premature, which in essence will slow or prevent growth until intersection improvements come along through some other mechanism. Two, we could allow the intersection to degrade in both capacity and safety. Three, we could, of course, spread the cost of these capacity enhancements across all of our existing taxpayers. In the city of Prior Lake, 94% of our taxes come from residential homeowners. There is no other place to put it than on existing homeowners. I'd like to conclude my remarks and share that the very growth that cities have planned for calls for 527 to move forward in this session. The intuitive rationale to do so that supports passage is already in statute for the other four fees. Thank you for having me before you this morning. I do ask for your support in advancing the bill, and I certainly would be happy to stand for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Briggs. I think we're going to wait and do questions at the end. I think all of the testifiers will be sticking around. The next testifier is Kenneth Ondich from the City of New Prague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Ken Ondich. I serve as the Planning and Community Development Director for the City of New Prague. I am testifying in support of House File 527, and I also wanted to thank Representative Mason for authorizing this needed bill. In my community of New Prague, where I have worked and lived for over 16 years, street infrastructure, among other city infrastructure, such as water, sewer, parks, et cetera, is necessary because of the proposed residential development. But in light of this court decision, Harstead versus Woodbury, we are unsure of how to proceed in terms of street infrastructure specifically. Historically, developers in New Prague have paid fees related to street infrastructure, and this has been vital to our continued growth. I wanted to relay just one example of how vital it has been to New Prague's growth. A developer back in 2005 proposed a 774 residential unit development on 253 acres, a very big development for New Prague indeed. With only one existing roadway to service the development, and additional access to the state highway would be necessary for this development. Luckily, we have a comprehensive plan, and we had an identified major roadway within that development that the developer was aware of upon proposing the development, and that ultimately connected to that state highway, resulting in a new intersection being created. Discussions between MnDOT, the city, and the developer determined that there would be improvements necessary for the development. We had a development agreement with that developer that noted that the development did have substantial impact to the state highway, that improvements were necessary, which the developer would be responsible for their proportional share of the improvements. Initial improvements were made by the developer, and that was really at the day one stage where they had to put in turn lanes and other striping, and that was only for the first stage. Long term, and was also under discussion with MnDOT, was that further intersection control evaluation study would be needed. Working with MnDOT, and specifically New Prague work with District 7, we were enabled to come up with a plan initially that required a traffic signal, and we entered into another agreement with the developer to pay $175,000 towards a $250,000 signal. Now, at this time, MnDOT was changing their protocol for intersections, and it eventually morphed into a roundabout. And the cost of that roundabout increased to $932,000 at the request of MnDOT. One of the reasons that project changed is we were able to obtain some grant money, federal grant money, for this roundabout. And additionally, We're able to bring in other fees through a cooperative agreement with MnDOT. So we obviously had an increase in the project cost, but we also had the ability to bring in other funds so that the developer wasn't burdened with those quite as fully. So all told on this $932,000 roundabout project that was caused by the need for the residential development, the developer's share was about $286,000 of that. And as I noted, the rest was from a federal grant and from cooperative MnDOT funding agreement. So without this legislation, that additional portion of funding that the developer had paid would have been left to the city taxpayers to pay for that development, or we would have had to consider it to be premature, which our subdivision ordinance does currently provide for. We can say that a development is premature if streets do not exist to support that development. This is a very difficult predicament for the city of New Prague and other small cities like New Prague that are feeling growth pressure. If cities are unable to pay for the needed street development, we will probably stop growing, which is really counter to what the legislature said they want, which is more housing. New Prague did have nearly 500 residential lots available at one point before the economic downfall, and we're now down to close to about 60 lots today, and we are being faced with new development. And this question of having new streets, particularly to pay for these larger streets caused by the development, is once again at our forefront. And we would, being a better community, we feel this legislation is of the utmost importance for our continued growth and development, while also noting that burdening our taxpayers with these new streets is really not a viable option, as we do have other older streets which still need attention and rehabilitation and reconstruction. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ondich. Our next testifier is Ted Kowalski with Spring Lake Township.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ted Kowalski. I'm the township supervisor with Spring Lake Township, which is just a little bit south of city of Prior Lake. I'm also a land developer, have been for 30 years. I'm also a builder, have been for 35 years. I'm also a member of the Board of Realtors. I'm a member of Housing First. So I bring a little bit of different perspective to this argument. Other people that are going to testify later are saying, will probably testify, that they don't believe this is a good idea, that it's a new tax. It's not a new tax. These roads that we have in our communities have been getting built and have been paid for by development. It's simply being done without your legislative oversight on how it's being charged across our state. This will give it some continuity and some what I would call good math. The developers and the people that are looking to develop and the landowners can feel comfortable that there'll be good math associated with the fees that are being charged. It won't be arbitrary. Our unique situation in Spring Lake Township, we're about a 32-square-mile township of about 4,000 people. And how we're unique is we are permanent rural residential. So our township isn't being held to be redeveloped into urban lots. It's going to be developed into 2.5-acre home sites, and that is its final resting place. It will be 2.5-acre home sites. City sewer and water services will not extend to this part of our township. So for us to take our growth that's been planned by the Met Council, we need to develop in an orderly way. The problem we have is when a farmer comes to develop his property, he's been farming for, 80 years, paying taxes and picking rocks, and now it's his turn to retire. The community, Scott County, is asking him for certain upgrades on the county roads. Well, and it's all falling upon the first developer to come to the table, the first landowner. He's got to put in all the infrastructure. The farmer next to him that's going to develop next pays zero. So the first guy to the plate pays the whole tab. That's inequitable. That's not fair, and it's slowing growth. So what's happening in Spring Lake Township, instead of us getting, say, 12 or 14 home sites on a 40-acre parcel, because of these big infrastructure improvements that are being loaded on the first guy to the table, that farmer's deciding, well, I'll just split it into three lots with just three driveways on the county road. I don't got to do the big infrastructure, and I'll get whatever money I can because I'm 80 and I need to get this done. I can't wait. We keep hearing this argument. Well, it's premature then. Just wait. This guy can't wait. He's 80. His wife's got cancer and he wants to move on. He needs to move now. He can't afford the infrastructure that's being required on the first guy to the table. that simple solution is have an equitable distribution of those infrastructure costs to whoever it impacts. That to think when we keep hearing this argument that this is a new tax, this isn't a new tax. This is being paid for by the development and the landowners all along. It's just being done because of the case with Harstad and Woodbury. What we've been shown is it's been done without legislative authority. We're asking you for the authority to charge a fair and equitable fee for the improvements that we need. Ask yourself this question. Had it not been for a reasonable and equitable way to charge for sewer and water expansion, how would any of this be? We wouldn't have any growth. So please give us a solution so we can take the growth that we need to have in Spring Lake Township equitably for our farmers and our landowners. Thank you, and I'll stand for questions too if you have any.
Yeah, we'll do questions at the end, but thank you, Mr. Kowalski. Our next testifier is Carl Christian Johansson with the Minnesota Association of Townships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for hearing this bill. My name is Carl Christian Johansson, and I am a staff attorney with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Towns are not commonly thought of as the municipality to use this fee. However, towns do get developments and will need turn lanes and traffic control devices when these developments come in. The average township is approximately 75% property tax dependent, and they're already supporting most of their road budget through local property tax. Without these fees, you're basically asking all the taxpayers in the township to pay for the infrastructure that is needed because of this the new development. And this would be substantially unfair, as you're asking for taxpayers to essentially subsidize the developer and their development. A town could specially assess the families that buy within the development, but this would be unfair, difficult, and unpopular. An assessment will feel as if there are hidden fees or as if the families are being nickel and dimed for already known improvements that had to be done. Townships need these fees to support safe roads. The costs related to the new developments are inevitable and should be collected in the most efficient, convenient, and fair way. Street impact fees allow for the collection from a single point and with only a few private parties involved. Overall, this protects both the current taxpayer and those purchasing into the development from unfairness and surprise. And because the use of this fee is limited to the purpose which it was charged, the amount charged must be related to the actual cost of the improvement. This fee is fair to developers as well. We ask for your support of House File 527 and the communities that will benefit from it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johansson. And we'll take questions at the end. The next testifier is Peter Coyle, testifying on behalf of Housing First Minnesota.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to testify briefly this morning. I appreciate it. First of all, my name is Peter Coyle, Larkin Hoffman. I represent Housing First Minnesota. As part of my professional obligations, I also represent developers and builders and construction companies across the state. And so my testimony this morning reflects that experience as well as my response to the legislation that's before you. First of all, several years ago, Governor Dayton convened a Blue Ribbon Task Force that was focused on trying to figure out a way to ensure that more housing was built for more people to be able to purchase more affordably. And unfortunately, the bill that's before you this morning goes in exactly the wrong direction. By proposing a new tax on housing, and I'm going to call it a tax, and I'll explain why in a minute, by proposing a new tax on housing, we are in fact going to cause housing in Minnesota to be more expensive than it already is. And as my colleague Nick Erickson will testify in a few minutes, Minnesota is already an outlier by having among the most expensive regulatory costs for housing, causing us to be one of the most difficult housing markets, particularly for folks that are trying to buy their first home. So why do I call this a tax? I'll start with the fact that in Bloomington or Eagan or any other city in Minnesota, when a developer comes in with a development of any sort that involves a subdivision, I can tell you with assurance that they pay for all the street improvements that their project implicates, whether they're the new streets that have to be constructed to support the subdivision or the improvements to the adjacent streets that are necessary because of the added demands on capacity. And that can include traffic signals or roundabouts, as the case may be, as the testifier from New Prague noted. That is, in fact, how the process works and continues to work, irrespective of the Supreme Court decision that several people have referenced. So it's important to understand that there is already in statute, through the subdivision process, the means to require developers to pay their fair share and more of the transportation costs that are related to their project. The bill that's before you adds yet another cost, a tax. And why is it a tax? Because the dollars that would be raised are not paying for impacts that the project itself generates, but will be banked for some future project, some other day, in some other place, to be determined based solely on a master plan that the city may have for the entire city. The statutory requirement that we feel is important to hold to is one that would require that any expenditure of transportation dollars be directly related to the project that's before the city. And that's what the current subdivision process allows for. So the extent to which this bill would raise new fees to be imposed on development, the pernicious negative aspect of it is it's a tax on the person that's not there yet able to vote. And it's there by design because if several people have testified already, they'd rather not have the general taxpayer pay the bill for the larger transportation improvements that benefit the community as a whole. And frankly, we think that's bad public policy. And then secondly, the statutes already allow for cities to impose unusual transportation costs by way of a special assessment process. That's the constitutionally tested way to ensure that properties that benefit from transportation improvements actually pay for those improvements. I can appreciate, as one of the testifiers noted, that these are politically unpopular, they're difficult to do, they can be painful. I get that. Those of you who've served on city councils, you understand how challenging that can be. But that doesn't mean it's a wrong way to go about it. It's the fairest way to go about it, and it's what the Constitution requires, with all due respect. So lastly, Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, what I would say is it's being suggested by some that this really only applies to new housing. In fact, this bill will apply to all new development that requires a subdivision. It could be a commercial project. It could be an industrial project. It could be new senior housing. It could be a nonprofit use of some sort. So it's a very dramatic expansion of a city's authority to impose a fee/tax on any new development, which we think is the wrong way to go. And my final comment then is the language is so broad and it creates so many ambiguities and uncertainties that, regrettably, I think it will be a subject of future challenge if the legislature were to enact it. And I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the chance to testify. I'll stand by for questions if you have any for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Our next testifier is Nick Erickson, representing Housing First Minnesota as well.
Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chair, thank you for having us today. Before I begin my remarks, I just want to note that I'm struck by until Mr. Coyle spoke, the lack of a mention of the missing party in this conversation, and that is the home buyer, because that is who is central to this discussion, because that is who is paying this new housing tax. So my name is Nick Erickson. I'm with Housing First Minnesota. I'm their director of regulatory affairs, and we're here today to offer our respectful opposition to this bill. This new housing tax, it's written of, by, and for local governments at a time when our state is already facing historic and unprecedented challenges with its housing market. Minnesota's housing affordability is the lowest in the Midwest. Our state's inventory of available homes is the worst in the nation and consistently ranks at the bottom. And most shamefully, our housing equity gap is the widest here in the Twin Cities in the entire nation. Frankly, if we're thinking of adding a new tax on housing at this point, that is unconscionable. The 2018 Housing Task Force convened stakeholders to chart a new path to heal our state's broken housing ecosystem. Central to this were two main points. One, add new homes, particularly at lower price points, and two, to lift regulatory roadblocks. Progress on these goals has sadly been minimal. We've seen entrenched special interest groups hold tightly to the regulatory powers and revenue streams. Simply put, everyone agrees in concept that we should be lifting these roadblocks and building housing that's more affordable, but no institution wants to lift their own individual roadblock. Today, with House File 527, we're stepping yet further in the wrong direction. We're considering the creation of a new housing tax, an expensive and exclusionary roadblock that could be used to make the state's housing problems worse. Local governments have long sought this authority after the Supreme Court has twice, not once, but twice struck down illegal attempts to place these fees into subdivision housing agreements. If past behavior is any indication of how this tax will affect the state's housing market, we can take a look through it how it has in the past. This is not a modest tax. We've seen upwards of $8,000 being placed on new housing, particularly the lower price points, townhomes that would have otherwise been affordable market rate townhomes. As Mr. Coyle said, this is on top of what homeowners already pay for transportation infrastructure and area improvements. All streets, curbs, gutters, warning sirens, lights, sidewalks, all turn lanes, stoplights, infrastructure modifications adjacent and related to the development footprint. And these are on top of parks, trails, ponding, open space, tree preservation, utilities, and financial security. On top of all those costs, which easily exceed $50,000 on a brand new home here in Minnesota, local governments are still asking for more. The notion that development must pay its own way is one of the most misleading statements in the housing policy discussion. Development is a process. It is not a person or an entity. It is the prospective home buyer. It's your friends, your family, your neighbors, maybe even one of the people on this call that are trying to achieve the dream of home ownership. One who would get this fee and would place them further back in getting into homes. This proposed tax is being called an impact fee. As Mr. Coyle said, this is among the most controversial and litigated tools in the local government toolbox. And this is because of the consistent lack of transparency and lack of demonstrated benefit to the home buyer who's paying for this tax. And of note, places like California, a state which has seen its housing market fundamentally collapse, they're actually looking at repealing these taxes on housing because it's making their housing problems worse. Adding a roadblock to housing access when Minnesotans need to have roadblocks lifted will only serve to drive our housing problems deeper and deeper in the state. We ask the committee to oppose this measure and focus its energy instead on increasing homeownership access and opportunities for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Next testifier is Paul Egger with Minnesota Realtors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Egger, and I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Minnesota Realtors is a statewide business trade association with a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals, working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding our opposition to House File 527. Minnesota Realtors' 2021 legislative session agenda includes supporting actions that will increase housing affordability and availability, and opposing actions that will increase the cost of homeownership. By authorizing a street impact fee that could be applied to new housing developments, we believe House File 527 would increase the cost of housing and reduce affordability. Recently, Minnesota Realtors released our annual report on the Minnesota housing market covering the year 2020. In a year when good news was generally in short supply due to COVID-19, the housing market provided some good news, with closed sales finishing the year up 8.4% over 2019. However, our 2020 annual report also shows there are clear challenges in the areas of affordability and availability. We have a lack of inventory, particularly at the most affordable price points, those homes priced under $300,000. This poses a significant challenge to getting more Minnesotans into home ownership. That lack of inventory is holding the market back. We have seen a steep decline in inventory for years, and we ended 2020 with only 1.1 months of supply, far short of the 4 to 5 months of inventory we need for a healthy market that is well-balanced for buyers and sellers. With a shortage of inventory, both new construction and existing homes, the cost of home ownership will continue to rise, pricing many low to moderate income Minnesotans out of the market, We encourage the legislature to resist imposing higher costs for new development, which in turn also results in upward pressure on the cost of existing properties. Mr. Chair, thank you again for allowing me to share our concerns with House File 527.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. Our next testifier is David Wershey from Wershey Homes.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is David Wershey with Wershey Homes. I also have a land development company. I've been a member of the CMBA for countless years, also a member of the Realtors Association, and we do have a land development and rental home business as well. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm coming at this from a little different perspective. I don't have anything prepared that I'm going to be reading. That sounds great, but this is a personal experience, and I typically try to stay away from this stuff. But when Steve Gottwald called me and said, here's what's going on, what do you think? I said, I feel like I need to say something. You know, I read the bill, and you know, clarifying the understanding of it is a challenge. There isn't anything in there that tells us how we're going to calculate these fees. But my most recent experience is I just completed a small 22-lot subdivision in November. And the amount of fees that are there already are large, and I can't imagine, you know, adding more on to this. Do the cities really know what it costs to develop a piece of land and develop a lot? In a small 22-lot subdivision, we have fees alone of over $200,000. That's $9,300 per lot. Okay, this doesn't include land costs. This doesn't include infrastructure costs. If we include the land costs, we're going to have per lot fee or per lot cost of over $35,000. And the infrastructure on only 22 lots is $1.1 million. So we're going to have, with land, lots, and everything included, we're going to have a cost of over $93,000 per lot. And we can talk later about the need for affordable housing, but at $93,000 per lot, that doesn't include interest, that doesn't include carrying costs, it doesn't include profit, it doesn't include marketing, and it doesn't include acquisition fees, because we don't have this money and we have to borrow it from the bank. So the true cost of the lot is extremely more than $93,000. You know, can we really tell our residents, oh, wait, but I need another $8,000 to $10,000 for this? And the way I understand the bill, we need to pay this before we even get an approval on it. You know, it's really, really hard to swallow. Developing land is expensive, it's time consuming, and it's costly. To not just the land developer, but the end user. So we're already dealing with so many things as builders and developers. We're dealing with lumber prices, labor costs, construction loan process, stormwater management, and God forbid you want to do something in Minnesota in the winter, you got to deal with the extra cost of digging through the frost and heating a house to be able to build it for people, because we know we can't build homes within the 8-month window of warm weather in Minnesota. You know, counseling our clients on sticker shock happens every year, and now we have to, you know, expect to counsel them on $8,000 to $10,000 more per lot that they have to pay. I mean, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if anybody thinks that the developer is paying for this. Our consumer is paying for it. Our homeowner is paying for it. It doesn't get absorbed anywhere. So I'm just curious, and I want to say that I'm opposed to this. Obviously, I think this is, you know, we're dealing with enough constraints. And our homeowners are dealing with it too, because, you know, how are they going to swallow additional fees? And where are we as developers going to get the money to upfront pay for these things?
Yeah. Okay. Fortunately, if you can wrap it up here, because we have one more testifier and we need to leave time for questions and discussion here.
Absolutely. So I'm just wondering if anyone's been out of the country lately. If you have, You've seen that most people live in apartments, and there's a reason for that, and that's because it's so expensive to live and develop and buy homes in other countries. We have an American dream here that's fading. And small builders and small developers are going to be handcuffed in building their companies and in developing land. It's going to be left to the national builders, and the small guys are going to get backed in a corner.
All right, thank you very much. We have one more testifier, Garrett Christensen.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Garrett Christensen, and I serve on the Elk River City Council. This testimony today is my own and does not represent the Elk River City Council as a whole. Thank you for allowing me time to speak on House File 527 through my experiences and role I serve in my community. State funding mechanisms, bonding, other local options are transparent ways to fund local infrastructure projects. A street impact fee is not. We're in the midst of a home ownership crisis coupled with some of the sparsest inventory we have seen in years. It is rare to find a home on the market for more than a week out here in Elk River. And on top of that, good luck being a first-time home buyer in a bidding war. My wife and I are raising five children and cannot imagine building the home of our dreams in today's landscape with the direction our state and local governments are going. We just happen to be at the right place at the right time as first-time home buyers coming out of the housing market collapse in 2012. Unfortunately, the majority of Minnesota families won't get as lucky as we did. At the city level, cries for regulatory and fee relief are growing louder and louder amongst both taxpayers and developers. Here in town, you can expect to spend around $750,000 in park dedication fees for new construction of a 200-unit apartment building on a blighted property. This does not include sack and whack fees, plan review fees, easement vacation applications, ordinance and land use amendment fees, staff services fees, and other miscellaneous fees associated with the development of property. So, and I've heard this question with other testifiers, but I'm going to ask it again. Who pays for that? Well, who pays for that is the end user. And no matter which way you spin it, whether it be the taxpayer up front or pass through the developer, the end user is the taxpayer that put you and I into office. If given the authority to make this decision at a local level, I would vehemently oppose House File 527 as I see firsthand that the root cause of lack of available and affordable housing is the direct result of excess fees and regulation and overtaxation. Adding a street impact fee is not a solution to this growing problem. As someone who works the front lines of my community through leadership, I ask that you promote growth and promote families, not hinder them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Appreciate that. Members, questions. I'll kick this off. I'd like to go back to Ms. Gao and just give you an opportunity, since you went first, to respond to the later testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I appreciate that. I do want to acknowledge, I know that this fee is something that would be a cost to development. That's not something that I'm going to deny. It is, and so it is part of what is in the calculation. It is part of what is passed on to home buyers. But without this authority, what'll happen is that it will never be a fee that's paid for by developers. And the only reason that we have it is because of the development itself. To pass this cost on to the existing tax base when they have not had a say in it just doesn't make sense. One of the things that I had heard, and I really resonates with me, and a lot of the work that the league is doing and is really important to cities, is around affordable housing. That is important because all of our communities across the state need to have that. It looks different in different parts of the state, but it is really important. And so cities use different tools. They have all sorts of things. They waive fees. They waive any building permit fee, water, sewer hookups, when it's for affordable housing. They use the money from the existing tax base to support those purposes. This bill is different. This bill would provide that the development pay for some of it. Now, if it were truly affordable housing, we will step up and support those needs to make it easier to develop and have affordable housing in our communities. Representative Elkins, I think that that's where I'd like to start. I imagine that there are other questions from other members, and so I will stop there.
Yeah, thank you. So I see Representative Berg and Representative Mecklen have questions. Representative Berg? And you need to unmute. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had two questions, which Ms. Cao already answered, one about affordable housing. And then my second question is to Mr. Ondich from New Prague. And I'm wondering if the special assessment covers all the costs of the street.
Special assessment does not cover 100% of the costs. There still typically is a local share in that. In our particular example I gave, we obtained a federal grant, some safety dollars involved there. And the reason for that is we had a school that was actually utilizing the intersection, and the turn lanes that were there previously were deemed to be unsafe for children traveling through that intersection and the parents dropping off and picking up. But that was a sizable share that we were able to put extra effort and work into rather than have it be a taxpayer local share. And then MnDOT had obviously a share in the leg of that as well with their cooperative agreement funding. So no, it was developer was about 30% of the payee on that particular roundabout through the assessments. And, you know, that was quite a reduction from what it could have been because at a local level, we stepped up to, you know, help support bringing other funds.
Okay. Representative Berg, do you have any follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree this is quite the contentious issue and listening to all the back and forth we've heard today. As somebody who does work in this field, I do have great concerns about this as well. I've heard from many city staff members who you know, are in support of it, that are trying to find money, and I get that. One thing I'm not hearing here, though, is nobody's talking about the additional revenue. I think the New Prague, he talked about a development that was 700 plus units. The developer ended up putting up $286,000. But what about the revenue that those 700 units eventually bring to the city? Where does that get factored into all this equation is one. The other question I have or thought is when a home buyer is absorbing or taking this, it's being passed on to them. They are then financing this, which basically in the course of that mortgage will double that fee. On top of that, their home evaluation project is based upon that fee being included in that initial purchase, which is what your property taxes are based on. And it is also what your homeowner's insurance is based on what it's going to cost to rebuild it should it get wiped away by a bad storm. And I'm not hearing any of these conversations coming to fruition. And I have a question for Mr. Wershe, if he would be able.
Mr. Wershe, are you still with us here? If so, you need to unmute. Yeah, you're, if you're saying anything, I think you're still muted is what I see. If you can unmute yourself. He may have stepped away, it looks like.
Well, Mr. Well, maybe he'll come back. I have another question for, if possible, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Christensen?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Christensen, in your experience, I mean, you touched on it lightly, but have you seen where any of these types of fees have actually driven the development and brought it to a stop, or they pulled back out and did not develop the land and build these 200 apartments that you mentioned lately?
Yeah, so and the example I gave you was a more recent one, not the only one, but yeah, we do come across that. I see more and more now in my third year on council that these projects don't come to fruition. We barely get past really any kind of movement on these projects for the pure fact that it's just not profitable to build new in some of these situations without concessions from the city. And, you know, when you look at some of the fees that are already in place through state statute that allows us to take those fees, we have now become reliant on those, right? And so any kind of concession that the city makes is affecting the taxpayer. And I just see this as another fee or another, you know, regulatory process that, again, is just going to hurt people like me and my constituents in Elk River.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So we have two amendments to consider as well. So Representative Joachim, you have a short question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do understand. Thank you first, City Council Member Christensen, for your service. I served 9 years on the City Council, and I know how hard it is to balance the budget and want to make sure that all your taxpayers are taken care of. So cities really aren't developers, and I don't understand why they should have to bear all the burden, because it does pass through all the taxpayers. And I know there's concern about the taxpayers moving into the new development, but you do have to think about the entire city. So one of my questions maybe is to, just a brief one, I have many, but I'll just direct a brief one to Chair Mason. So with this bill, are you requiring cities to use this tool, or is this optional?
Chair Mason.
Oh, I'm not. Okay. Yeah. At this point, I guess I would consider it an
option.
An option.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no other hands raised, Representative Quam, I believe you have an A1 amendment to offer.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Please speak to your amendment.
Basically, the A1 is saying that cities would need to actually plan out and understand what it is that they would be using this fee for. In other words, if you're just assessing a fee because you think there's going to be something happening in the future, you're not doing your due diligence. And if you are doing your due diligence and you know that for this development you'll have to do X, Y, and Z, I would think most cities would already have that worked out to where, as was noted by one of the testifiers, that they would be doing adding the lane into the adjacent street and et cetera. But if, you know, this becomes law and they use it and you do your due diligence, go ahead and do that project. Don't have this sitting in a, slush fund for whatever you decide to that you need to do for transportation across the entire city. Now, because of discussions, I would like to do an small oral, which would be on 1.3 and 1.8, change the 3 in year period to 5. So it'd be just changing the 3 to a 5 on those two lines, and that would give additional time. And I was wondering if that would be acceptable to the chair for that oral amendment to change that number.
I think that would be non-controversial. Is there any discussion to that? Is there anyone who objects to that oral amendment? Not hearing any.
I do have one question.
Yeah.
In my experience, even the 5 years may not be enough. So, I mean, I'm willing to take the 5. It's better than 3. Mm-hmm. But I still don't think that is, may not be realistic in all cases.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with Chair Mason that, you know, 5 years would be better than 3. My own perspective on this is that, as you know, one of the testifiers said earlier, in some cases, you know, they think it was Mr. Kowalski, I think it was, who was talking about how under the current regime, sometimes the first developer into a general area under development ends up being saddled with everything. In some cases, an area that that is newly under development, the area that would be served by the road that that the city would be trying to collect the impact fees for might develop over a period of 10 years or more. The idea is to put this money into an escrow fund so that the at the point where the accumulated level development actually requires the road to be built, that at that point the funds would be there. And I'm wondering if Ms. Gao would like to just comment on this one briefly as well.
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your comments. That's actually what I was going to say too, is that it oftentimes that trigger of when that street improvement is needed is something that's planned for. And so first of all, I should acknowledge Representative Plum and I have had conversations about this amendment. I do appreciate that in light of the conversation, he understood that 3 years is not sufficient. I agree with you and Chair Mason that 5 years may not be enough time as well. But because cities are not in control of when development occurs and when that trigger is met, thinking about the need for a turn lane, for example, that really does fall into the hands of the developers. If you have a short time frame, what would happen is the developers would have a windfall. And I know that that's not the intention, but we do want to work on this. I'm happy to continue to have conversations with Representative Kwam on this, but to figure out what time frame or to ensure that we can still have it tied to the development itself and get the street improved. We'll take some more work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. So if there's no further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I thought that I basically you were responding to my request for an oral, and I would like to be able to finish the continuation, okay. Plus be able to, since you let multiple people comment upon that, I find it humorous when someone says it's a windfall to an entity when they get, if they were to get back money that they were paying into a fee that was unused. I think that is a bit of a stretch to reality to be able to paint something like that, because frankly, this is taking money out and adding to the cost of affordable housing. We do things to these bills not because of the best situations. We do it in order to prevent the extremes on both sides.
Yeah.
And the idea that we could actually force a city to do the planning and execute in a timely fashion, I think, is logical and prudent. The idea of, there's going to be a turn lane added onto the adjacent street. Well, common practice amongst the better run cities is that that is worked out when the development is done. As in, you're doing the development, the developer agrees, yes, I need a turn lane. That type of thing. My understanding was the reason for these thousands and thousands of dollars per unit was because of having to add an additional thing to the transportation, feeding into that area, improve the road, et cetera. And thinking that, well, we're going to wait till 4 or 5 developments are done before we do anything to the road. Well, now you've already got a problem and you're fixing it after the fact.
Hey, Representative, so we need to get your formally moved. Do you want to go ahead and do that?
I believe that an author can make a technical change to the amendment without if it's not objection, if there's no objection, and then it's offered as the author's amendment, or not the author's amendment, but the author. What I'm saying is I haven't moved the amendment, therefore the changing of one word from 3 to 5 in 2 locations would be included in the moving of the amendment.
Okay, well, either we are going to have to vote to incorporate it. I'm sorry, I thought that you had moved the amendment itself as well.
No, I had not. That's why I asked to begin
okay,
with.
Can I
ask the author of the bill a question?
You may.
Yes.
We both are on the next committee that this goes to.
Yep.
We've had some discussion on this. Is the author amenable to working on coming to a consensus on the verbiage of this amendment and working on it in the next committee?
Okay, if I'm understanding you, you're not going to offer the amendment now, but we'd be willing to work on the gist of the amendment going into the next committee. Is that correct?
That is the intent, that we are able to come with some consensus to improving this bill so that it has some safeguard and assists cities to do it in an appropriate fashion.
Okay. So, yes, I would be willing to work with you to see if we can make progress from your perspective. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. And so, Mr. Chair, I will not put this amendment forward and work with the author in order to get some consensus to improve this bill.
Okay, great. That's wonderful. And then Representative Plum, do you also have an A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the A2 amendment is going to be put forth by another member of the committee.
Okay. I had you down for that, but who is offering the A2 amendment? Representative Olson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, may I speak to that amendment?
You may.
Excellent. So I'll try and make this brief. My biggest concern here is the idea of I've seen cities raise fees and assess fees for services while at the same time preventing them from having to come to reality and go to their voters and say, hey, we need to raise this levy to pay for this growth on the understanding that, hey, 128 new buildings being built for an average of $440,000 for a new house, that's going to bring massive tax bases in addition to what they're already receiving. So it is an investment in the future. A city would be foolish not to do so. There are multiple other avenues of approach here. I understand the argument of giving cities tools that they determine that they need, and I understand that in some way, shape, and form, giving cities options to make their own decisions is always pretty much the best idea. And in this case, this might be handing them a tool for success. It also might be handing them just enough rope to hang themselves. But that being said, my biggest concern is the idea of, are we allowing cities, the city council, to hide fees, to con citizens into paying a fee just to move into the community? And so what this amendment would do is it would add a level of transparency to what is actually happening, the operations of this city ordinance, if it were to be adopted, just so then all the citizens would realize, hey, this is what we're doing. We're going to add this fee, so then new people who come into this city have to pay this street assessment fee, even though there are a couple other options. But we want to save you, person. You know, you're hearing the argument that citizens who already live there shouldn't maybe pay for the development of their city, which I would argue every single day that in my city that I was the mayor of, if someone wanted to build a house, I would have done absolutely everything I possibly could to get them on our tax basis, including providing them with tax relief. You know, we had establishments that we said, all right, you don't have to pay taxes for 7 years, just come here. And so there are a lot of tools. I understand the idea of the tool belt, adding more to cities' options, but I think that we need to add a level of transparency to this. And so that would be my amendment.
Great. Thank you, Representative Olson. And just very briefly, this amendment is in your package, but it would require cities to post notification of the intent to collect an impact fee. Any further discussion? If not, I think, Madam Chair, do you recommend approval or not of this amendment?
I guess I am going to suggest that we do not approve this. I've done a lot of door knocking over the years, and I can tell you there aren't many people that really welcome development or the extra fees, as I'm understanding this. So I would not approve. I would be opposed.
Okay. And if I don't see any other hands raised, let's proceed to a vote on this amendment. Can we do this orally, Mr. Strohmeyer?
Yes, we can do this orally unless someone calls for roll call.
Okay, so if members can unmute, all in favor of this amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no. No.
No.
Yeah, the amendment does not pass. So really, Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair? Is division appropriate in committee, or would they have had to ask for a roll call ahead of time?
I don't think if division is appropriate in committee, would have had to request a roll call in advance. So I think that there is an A3 amendment in the package. Representative
Mr. Quam, Chair,
are you offering the A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, in past committees over the years, we have taken division. So are those committees in error, or have you consulted with nonpartisan staff to see?
I have not, but I have never personally heard of a division being requested in a committee.
Well, actually, in 2013, in the Energy Committee, when the chair was presenting her bill and the vice chair was running the committee, I recall that happening. I don't recall the specific date. But for the future, if you can reference and get back to me with what determination they're using to not allow the division. On the third amendment, I don't believe that was going to be offered.
Okay,
at this
thank
time.
You very much. So we need to get to a vote here quickly. We're actually over a few minutes. So if there is no further discussion, Representative Quam, do you want to request a roll call on the vote to the bill? And
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that with remote process that we're under,
we have to, yeah,
that the voting on a bill, we have to.
So Representative Mason, do you want to
move the bill?
Move the bill, yes.
To state governments.
Finance, okay. So clerk, will you take the roll?
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
We have 6 ayes and 3 noes.
So the bill is on its way to the State Government Finance Committee, and there's no other business to come before us. Meeting is adjourned. Thanks, everyone.